chamber and lower it. And we got gas so that we could go, and I could take this whole group of kids who were, you know, a little bit younger than I was. But yes, you're right, I did drive up there. It was my first driving experience, and why the state of New York let somebody that age drive a whole car full of other younger people, all misbehaved, and of course no seatbelts, who knows? I mean, wouldn't happen now.
What was the workday like?
It was probably 8 to 4 or something like that. It was pretty early. I remember it sort of early in the morning. I remember it being sort of wet on the in the fields in the morning. And it was hard work. And we, you know, brought our lunch. But he couldn't. He was, the farmer was desperate. He grew cauliflower for the for pretty much for export. It wasn't for local. It went down to the city. It was because the climate is right for that here. It went to New York City, and we helped harvest it and created it, and went on a truck to New York, I guess. What do you want to go back to school, free time? We've got a question.
Yes. What did people do for fun in Cooperstown? You said that there were schools and anything you needed.
Let's see. I can tell you what my parents did. They played tennis. My father did not play golf. He played golf when he first came here, but when we bought the house, when we moved over to the house on Beaver Street, he stopped playing golf. They were members of the country club and played tennis. My mom, my dad, somewhere early on in the early 30s, got interested in skiing. And he and some other people and my mom used to go out and cross-country ski on the hills. And it was late before the World War started. My dad and some other people were very interested in starting a ski tow. And we had a ski tow not far from here. In the wintertime, actually, I can't tell you what other people did in the summertime. Although, I guess the merchant class, I guess, went up to the lake on their boats. In the wintertime, when the there was serious ice on the lake, there was a serious fishing colony out by Cooperstown every year. And the people would bring their little fishing huts. They do that where you come from too, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was very big here for this. No longer is there. You'll see them out there now. They bring tents and they pop them up and they're there for the day and they're gone by the end of the day, which I find very odd. But they were for years. I remember and how, you know, a little fishing colony out near Cooperstown, and people would take their cars out there and race around in their cars in the wintertime and just generally to get out in the wintertime. There's always been a gym in Cooperstown where the Fieldstone building that's now part of the Hall of Fame was where the gym was when I was growing up until the 60s. Fairly recently, that was a gym, had a pool and squash courts and so on. People in the wintertime went on hikes with a man by the name of Cap Smith. For leisure, my childhood was quite separate from other people's because my friend Lynn McKeever, her parents, the surgeon who went to war with my dad, had a farm out on Cornish Hill. And we used to spend our weekends out there, Liv and I and her parents and her sister. And we'd spend the whole weekends out there. We had a pond and we had little gardens and stuff like that. So we were out there just being kids. And we're down behind my house playing in the outdoors. I don't remember much being inside except reading and being read to. Occasionally, I was allowed to listen to the radio, very occasionally. I don't know what my parents... Well, my dad didn't have a lot of free time. He was, you know, when he was... He worked a lot. A lot of demands. And I, what my mother did for her days, I can't. I know she ordered the food and the cook cooked it, but I couldn't tell you what else she did. And in my real childhood, of course, I know what she did during the war. But I guess she read books.
What values did your parents find important to teach to you and your brother and sister?
Money, thrift, good manners, please and thank you. Value of reading as a lifestyle. And I think the usual, we were not churchgoers, but I think we were brought up fairly strictly thou shalt not. Although, as I say, we were not churchgoers. Yeah, they were pretty strict about us learning all those things. We were very well disciplined, actually. And to our elders, respect for our elders. We're very lucky. I thought I was, now that I think of it, one of the luckiest children we ever was. I had both sets of grandparents, not only wonderful parents, but I had both sets of grandparents and one set of great-grandparents. And I adored my great-grandfather. I thought he was wonderful. And so, and all of them had lives of, he was the one intellectual, he was a publisher, of meeting interesting people, and they had a very quiet and unassuming way of getting along in the world that was, I think, a very, I think something they passed on to me. And I think the intellectual thing was probably, to me, it was just a matter of, always asking questions and never being quite satisfied that you know everything because you don't.
What did you adore most about your great-grandfather?
He read to me. He read Uncle Remus. He read. He put me on. He was very white-haired. I'll show you a picture of him when we were through. White-haired gentleman. He looked sort of like Mark Twain. And he was a friend, had been a friend of Mark Twain. He saw to it that I was introduced to all kinds of books. Like he read Kipling to me. He'd known Kipling, and he read Kipling to me. He read all kinds of things to me. Not often. I mean, we only visited him once in a while, and he came to visit us very rarely. But I do. Even now you can tell. He was sort of the light of my. He knew I had some kind of intellectual curiosity, and he fostered it, which was kind of cool.
How have those values shaped your life?
Oh, I think they absolutely changed my, I always, from the time I was in school, I love school. I love Knox. I love, you're not supposed to, but I really did. I love school. I love learning. I love all kinds of things. And that carried me through my college career. And I think even raising kids and so on and so forth, because I think they will tell you, my children would probably tell you that that was one of the things that came to them was the fact that just, and I think that's probably the reason that my children were doing what they do is because they've all sought it, they've sought what they could and they're doing very well at it. But I think, the intellectual curiosity and those kind of values, I think that's the most important thing I can remember.
Tell me about getting your Bachelor's of Arts from the Smith College in the 1940s.
Well, it was, first of all, I went to Smith because it was expected of me. Because my grandmother had gone to Smith and graduated in 1901. My mother had gone to Smith and all my female relatives had gone to Smith. So I wasn't out of choice. I just, as a matter of fact, after I took the college board examinations, my mother was staying with my father at the Army base. I remember coming out of that thinking, I wonder what would happen if I didn't do too well on those College Board examinations and I didn't get into Smith, because nobody had ever told me there was any other place. No, it was just expected. So I went to Smith. I was not a particularly good student. I didn't try particularly hard. I was, in the first couple of years, I didn't try particularly hard. I sort of thought I was going to coast through that. And then I kind of realized I wasn't going to, that I might have to put my mind to it. And then I became really interested in it again. I think the reason I liked Knox so much is I was good. I was better disciplined, and I liked, because I liked school, I was always, you know, sort of ahead of my class and so on and so forth. I think when you excel, I found that when I went to Smith, of course, everybody else there had been the top of their class too. I wasn't quite the large frog in the small puddle that I had been at Knox, and I wasn't all that good the first couple of years I was there. Then I found what I wanted to learn, which was history. And so, history and writing. And so I got a very good education. I did very well the last year I was here. In fact, I was asked to come back and be a teaching assistant when I got finished from one of my history professors. So I did all right. But I'd already signed a contract to come back to Knox, so I didn't take that job. Anyway, so yes, I got a very good education, which you might expect, which I have used, I hope, to some advantage.
How was a woman's obtainment of a degree viewed at that time?
It was considered a good way to get an engagement ring so you could marry, which I wasn't ready to do. But by the time I got out of college, it was... So my mother went to college. That's really, in fact, you know, women didn't go to work in the 20s. My grandmother's, I'm going backwards on this one, but my grandmother's class, actually, the women, when they went to Smith, the turn of the century then, they were learning to be missionaries and get out in the world, and they were much more apt to get out into the world than... the women of my mother's generation. On the other hand, by the time I came around, it was the non-working. They went out back home and got married and had raised children. That was what sort of my mother's generation was expected to do. That had kind of passed by the time, because of the war, going out and getting a job after college was sort of half expected of you, and you were sort of prepared for it, not really, not with a liberal arts education, but I did go on, and as I say, I went to Knox, taught for a while, and then I was in publishing for a bit before I married, but many women in my class, my class at Smith, did go out and have been in careers ever since. I was not one of them. I pretty much, after I married in 1949, I spent a lot of time dealing with what needs to be done in a community where your children are growing up. So, not a bit like, I never went back to a paid job after I married.
Do you have regrets about that?
Hmm?
Do you have regrets?
No. I hated going to work. I hated going to an office. I've been a volunteer, as you probably saw from your, from that. I've been a volunteer in many, many things. I've done a great many things. I've served on a great many boards. The biggest job I ever had was on the Board of Education. As soon as my children got into the public school system in Glenridge, New Jersey, I realized that there was room for improvement in the public school system. And I became very active in education, because education is what I think is most important in all our lives. And when I realized that there was room for improvement, I became active and eventually served on the Board of Education for many years, because it was important that my children got the best they could out of what was being offered. And both my husband and I had gone to away out of our communities to private schools of different sorts, but private schools. And we deliberately chose a community in New Jersey that was famous for its good schools and so on, so that we would not feel obligated to send them to a private school. But then once I made that decision and were living there, I realized that I could perhaps be something that would help in the community. Mm-hmm. That's way away from Cooperstown. Are you asking this about me, or
mm-hmm.
Okay? We've gotten miles from Cooperstown.
How did you meet your husband, Francis?
Skiing. I was teaching at Knox that winter after I graduated from Smith, and I was on my way to Boston to interview for a school job, because I wanted to get, it was time I got out of Cooperstown. And I stopped to go skiing for the weekend and decided that I really didn't want to live in Boston. And then the course of thought, I met the man who became my husband.
Did you run into him on the ski hill?
We were staying at the same lodge. We actually, both of us had known the people who run that lodge and never met before. And then we met, and I can remember Alice Vaughn saying to me, "Oh, I've got somebody coming for the weekend you're really going to like," which is, to me, like the kiss of death. But it turned out not to be. We did. We hit it off. We were married a year later here in New York. By that time, I had gone into a change direction, as it were, and decided that school teaching probably was not going to make it for me. Mm-hmm. And so I took this course at Radcliffe in Publishing Procedures, which is still in existence today, only it's in Columbia, and went to New York and had a brief career in publishing. Got married and got over going to work. I really did not like a 9-to-5 job.
Mm.
It's not my thing.
Mm. What most attracted you to Francis?
We never called him that. His name is Art. Don't use the first name at all. I don't know. He was an Irishman who was very bright and a great sense of humor, and we had a lot of things in common. He was not possibly, and this is may have been, I'm not sure about that. I've never known this. Because he was very different, his background was very different from mine, perhaps. That was the part of the attraction, I'm not sure.
So you called him Arthur?
Yeah.
Hmm. Tell me about when Arthur asked you to marry him.
When we married?
When he asked you to marry him.
Oh, we were doing something in New York. We were sitting at a bar on 96th Street. It sort of came about. We agreed to do that.
Tell me about your wedding.
When? Wedding? He was a Catholic. And that was part of the problem, was he was a Catholic. I was brought up as my parents. My mother was possibly an atheist, but at least an agnostic. She just really didn't believe in all this and stuff. And my dad had been brought up in a church-going family, but he was no longer going to church. And the idea that I would marry a Catholic, in the days when you really had to bring up your children as Catholics, and birth control was absolutely N-O, I think my dad and mom were a little bit concerned about that. So anyway, but you, we planned to get married, and we realized there were going to be obstacles, and the obstacles were considerably more than they are think they are now. One of them was that the priest here in Cooperstown, I wanted to be married in Cooperstown. The priest here said you have to get married in the church, and I wanted to get married in our house on Beaver Street. And that was going to be an issue. And finally, we just decided, oh, the hell with it, excuse me. Let's get married in New York City. So we decided to get married in New York City, and we were married in the rectory of St. Patrick's Cathedral. Not in the cathedral, but in the rectory. On a Sunday afternoon, very quietly, just family, and had some little reception at a house, some friends of my mother's, in a house in New York, and went skiing.
You and Arthur had 6 children together. Did you always want a large family?
I really did. I had realized that in my college experience, I had a professor who had a big family, and an English professor, and we were very close friends, and he and his wife and I were very close. So my roommate and I used to babysit for their big family, and I thought, you know, there's something about this, the interaction of the 6 children as opposed to the 3 of us, that I thought was pretty wonderful, and I really did want to have a big family. And I was very lucky because I had 3 boys and 3 girls.
What was the most challenging aspects of raising your children?
Money. We didn't have any when we started. And I haven't had a lot of experience being a housewife because I didn't have exactly a perfect role model. So just getting by, I think, the first few years was challenging, but fortunately we had supportive parents. His parents were very good about lending us money to buy a house, and we just got by, but I think that was, and I had never, I did babysit for the Bailey kids at college, but I didn't have much experience with that either, but you know, it's new to everybody, so. Just do it.
What values do you hope your children learn from you and Arthur?
Same things I was talking about earlier, the advantage of intellectual curiosity and education, good manners, the usual thou shalt nots. But I think value of besides the things that I think you see, just being getting along with people in the world and so on. I think the educational thing is, and I know it, I see it in my own children. It's the reading to the children and all of that to just keep them going and be good citizens.
What's your most treasured memory of being a mom?
Actually, you mean when the children were small or just in general?
Just in general.
Well, I'll tell you. My children famously, first of all, they all are very strong, have all very strong opinions. They always, you know, pretty much know everything. And when they get together, it's quite an interesting thing because they are now, well, some of them are over 60 now, so they've got opinions, and they got opinions. And they don't always agree with one another. And when we get together, sometimes there's some friction, and there are certain amounts of disagreement. But 2 years ago, I was having to have some major surgery, and the children rallied around in a way that I could not believe. By the first 24 hours, they worked out a schedule of who was going to be here with me, what for weeks on end. And I guess it's that rallying around that I has to be the most treasured thing I could bring from that, because I think it shows that I did something right, you know, along the way. And actually, even when I turned 80, They had a wonderful party for me. They had great posters made of all the photographs from all these albums. They scrounged around and found them. And they treat me very well now, and I'm very happy about that. And their children are, my grandchildren are pretty great too.
So Barbara, you are 86 years old, correct?
Yes, my dear, I am.
And you said on your CV that you still teach PSIA level 1.
I retired, actually. I still have my PIM. I am still legally a teacher, but I retired when I turned 80, teaching skiing. I still ski.
You still ski.
I skied last winter. I don't know whether I'm going to this one or not, because you may have noticed I have a limp, and I've got a hip that I should have replaced. I'm having a little trouble getting my body in shape to go skiing, but we're going to see about that. And anyway, yes, I started teaching skiing when I was in my 70s.
Wow.
I was bored. I was living in Vermont in the wintertime. I skied all my life. As you could, I started to ski when I was about 6, 7, which was very early in those days. And I skied. And my Gavin, my husband, and I met skiing. We went skiing on our honeymoon. And the children all know how to ski. And I have three children who are ski racers. And I have... So it's been very much a part of my life. It was the biggest recreational part of my life. And I, after my husband died, I skied in Europe for a while on trips. And then I went to the Rockies and Canada and so on. And one winter I decided that, hey, you know, why go on 2 week or 3 week trips? Why don't you just spend the winter someplace where you can ski all winter? You can do that. You don't have to stay in Cooperstown. So I went to Vermont. And about the third winter, I decided I was bored. I really needed more to do than get up in the morning and slide down the hill. So I inquired about, and there was a poster up at the ski resort saying they were looking for instructors for next year, and it said, you don't have to be a really great skier, but you have to like people and want to teach skiing. I thought, well, that fits. I'm not a really great skier, but he said, well, they'll teach you, you know, what you need to know. So I applied and I got the job. A job, and there were lots of us. And so the next winter, I went and learned how to do that, and I got my national PIN after the first year of teaching when I was 73. So, and I taught all those years. And what I did when I was, it turned 80, I just, well, first of all, two things happened. I decided I really didn't want to do it anymore. And the people I was living on the mountain, on the ski mountain, and the man who owned the apartment was not going to be able to be there anymore. So I kind of lost my spot on the mountain, and I was so spoiled that I decided that I wouldn't do it anymore.
What are your goals for the future?
I don't really have many. I'd like to live through the winter without getting my hip replaced. But I may have to have it replaced. I like to see, I have one grandchild I hope is going to graduate. I'm going to see graduate this year. I'm really concerned. One I'm concerned about. Of course, I'd love to live long enough to see how it all, those grandchildren, how it all plays out. But I'm not going to, so I don't have many goals. Just keep going from day to day and hope I can still walk around and live alone for a while. How can I have goals when I know what the end is, you know? It's not so far away. I know that. But
you were just skiing not so long ago.
And I'm hoping to ski again soon, but we'll see. I take care of, I don't know whether you're willing, I take care of most of the outside here. Not all of it, no. Well, I do mow. If I have to, I get on my tractor and plow a little bit. I like to keep healthy and keep my friends. And one of my things I do best is I'm making a lot of new friends because all my friends are dying. So my age group are dying. So I'm kind of alone as far as that goes. So I have no friends. Did you go to church? I miss, you know, did you go to church on Sunday?
I did.
Were they nice to you?
They recruited me to the choir.
They did.